The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Eric Metaxas Show.
Due to budget issues, Eric's been replaced by a cranky secondhand robot named Dr. Nuts and Bolts.
We assume you won't mind, but if sparks shoot out your radio, you'll know why.
So stand back.
And now, here's Eric 2.0.
Hey, folks, it's the Eric Metaxas Show. Welcome. There's no charge for you to stay here. If you're listening on radio, it's free. If you're watching us on YouTube, it's also free. Our goal is to bring you fascinating people, and I always succeed. For example, in this hour, I'm talking to Jim Dennison. Jim Dennison, how in the world do I describe you? You're the founder of the Dennison Forum. Is that a coincidence?
That's a coincidence. Yeah, that's why we used the name, because it just kind of seemed to kind of go with mine. Didn't have to change the spellings, didn't have to change the luggage tags. It was awesome.
That's why we named this show the Eric Metaxas Show. I thought, you know, what a coincidence. I'm Eric Metaxas.
It was already out there. You know?
The name is not being used. Yeah. So the Dennison, tell folks, I mean, I think of you as a pastor. You're the author of many books. But the Dennison Forum, what is that?
Well, we wonder that too. You know, it's an ongoing question, isn't it? So started 11 years ago, the basic point is to speak biblical truth to cultural issues. So I do that in a whole variety of ways. I write a daily article. We send about 220,000 subscribers, do a lot of social stuff that goes to about 1.7 million people a month and so forth, write a lot of books, do interviews like this. But the basic point behind what we're trying to do is to help people think biblically about cultural issues so they can use their influence to make an impact for Christ. And so whether it's
it's almost like you know what it's about. So I'm glad that it's named after you. Now, listen, the reason you're here, I just like to talk to people that I find fascinating and fun and interesting. But usually if they have a book, it gives us something to focus on. So you have just come out with a book. I don't have the title in front of me. Is it How God Sees America?
That's actually been out for a little while. Yeah, thank you for that. We did that several months ago. The most recent thing we did, I've done a series of biblical insights to tough questions. We're doing the sixth volume now. And we have one out on coronavirus that's specifically about coronavirus, oddly enough.
Well, I'm sorry, you have one out. You mean a book out?
Yes. Mm-hmm. A book out that deals specifically with coronavirus issues and such. It's kind of a special edition inside this.
Yes, because coronavirus is not normal. I knew that, Jim. Well, now, listen, I want to talk to you about how God sees America. Am I getting the title right? Because I don't have the paper in front of me.
That's terrific. Yeah, that works. Actually.
How God sees America. Now, you know, a lot of people would say, well, how arrogant to write a book claiming to know how God sees America. Now, I know you, Dr. Jim Dennison, and I know you're not an arrogant individual. So what do you say to people when they say, how in the world can you write a book with the title How God Sees America? How do you know how he sees America? Where are you coming from on that?
Well, I got a crystal ball, you know, and it kind of descended and it kind of sits here and the special divine revelation here and that sort of thing. As you know, the best way to look at the culture is through biblical lens, is to look at it through scripture. So we chose to look at culture through the Ten Commandments. We just chose to assess where we are in light of these enduring, obvious principles that are not just Old Testament, they're renewed in the New Testament, they're the basis for jurisprudence in Western culture, as you know, across all the centuries. They're these foundational blocks. If you're going to ask yourself, how can God bless a nation or how can God not bless a nation? This is the prism, I think, by which to look at that. So that's essentially what we did, is we just picked up these commandments and then we looked through that prism and asked, well, how are we doing with this? How are we doing with idolatry? How are we doing relative to adultery or relative to coveting, materialism, that sort of thing? And that was the prism by which we tried to ask the question.
Real quick, look at your camera instead of at the screen. You know what I'm saying?
There you go.
And we will cut that out. All right, Jim. So if we hold up America to, or we hold up the Ten Commandments to America to answer the question of your book, How Does God See America? What do you say in the book?
there's some good news and there's some bad news.
Right.
And some of that would not be surprising, would it? On the one level, Americans are more religious, you can say, than pretty much any other country in the Western world. When you compare our church attendance patterns, even in the worst case scenarios, to what you see in Europe, for instance, as you know, you find us to be far more committed to some kind of religiosity, committed to some level of Christian and church engagement. You're seeing a great deal of growth in the evangelical world right now. That's not being reported. You're hearing about the death of the church in America and such. But as Glenn Stanton and other people are indicating, if you're looking even at younger people, even millennials, in evangelical context and conservative Christianity, you're seeing a great deal of growth. You're seeing growth on college campuses. You're seeing some enormous advances for the gospel there. You're seeing the Holy Spirit working in a fifth grade awakening around the world. According to David Barrett's Christian Encyclopedia, more people have come to Christ in recent years than ever before. I have a good friend that works in the Middle East that says more Muslims have come to Christ in the last 15 years than the previous 15 centuries. He thinks more Jews have come to Christ in the last 20 years than the previous 20 centuries. So there's some remarkable good news that's happening. But of course, and we can talk about this, when you put up that moral prism and you're asking where we are relative to materialism, where are we relative to adultery and sexual ethics? Where are we relative to theft? And that's not just material theft. Where are we relative to coveting? Where are we relative to deceit? And really the loss of truth, the sense that truth is personal, individual, and subjective, we don't fare well. And those are the places where we obviously need to start making some huge changes.
And why did you write a book with this? Is this something that you've been chewing on for some time and you thought it would make a good book?
That's part of it. This has been in my heart for a long time, to get us to think biblically about our nation. But the other reason I wanted to do this was to give Christians some tools they could use as we're trying to assess how we can make an impact most effectively in the culture. I remember when I first found C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity all those years ago, changed my life, as did so many, obviously millions of other people. And he had this analogy there when he felt like he was being called into apologetics, that he felt like the place where he was being called was also the part of the line that was least offended. And so to it, he naturally went, as he said.
Well, the part of the line that was least defended. So what was that, you know, to use this military image, what was that in his culture? In other words, what did he feel that he needed to do in his culture?
Very similar to what we're talking about today. He felt like there was a need for somebody to come along with a mere Christianity approach, somebody that, to use Richard Baxter's phrase, somebody that wouldn't be focused specifically on high church Anglican or low church Anglican or this particular issue or that ideology, but rather try to get to the essentials, to the basics of the faith, and explain that and then defend that in a way that would be reasonable and accessible to the larger population. It all started as BBC broadcast talks, as you know, and they got turned into this remarkable book. And so I felt like there was a need for somebody to be able to speak biblical truth in the context of essential Christian faith. And I felt that same sense about this. I felt that there was a need to help Christians think biblically about our culture so they could find their place of influence. Where is it on that line that God is calling them to make a difference? What can I do with my cultural influence to make an impact for the gospel? If we don't know where the weaknesses are, it's sometimes hard to know where to go.
Before we go ahead with your book, How Does God See America? Just to go back briefly to C.S. Lewis's book, Mere Christianity, I don't remember where he got that phrase from. I assumed it was of his own coinage, but I think you just said it was Richard Baxter that he got it from.
And that's my understanding.
Baxter mm-hmm. is.
Yeah. Richard Baxter is a Puritan, was a Puritan thinker, a writer, a theologian, and somebody who, like Lewis, was really wanting to espouse a broader kind of Christianity that wouldn't be as tied to sectarian expressions and divisions and such as that. And so that's this phrase, mere Christianity, that he borrows, I think, from Richard Baxter, has this marvelous analogy for it. He says there's this house with many rooms. The rooms could be seen as analogous to various traditions, various denominations and such. And that's not Lewis's point. Lewis's point is to get you into the main room of the house. And then past that, he wants you to choose that room that works for you, wants you to go through that door that makes the best sense to you. But he wants to get you in the house. And he sees
what he's talking about. And I, part of the reason that I like what you do is because it's what's on my heart too. I think of so many people who are talking about, I'm a Presbyterian or I'm Reformed or I'm this or I'm that. And the real issue in America, at least as I see it, and that we're going to go to a break and we can talk about it when we come back. But the way I see it is that many people who claim to be Christians don't really understand mere Christianity. They don't understand the basics. And I think it's crucial that we understand the basics first, which is why I love C.S. Lewis and why I'm excited to talk to you about the book, How Does God See America? Folks, I'm talking to Jim Dennison. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
But now friends are acting strange. They shake their heads. They say I've changed. But something's lost and something's gained. And living every day.
Make like a Mr. Milquetoast, you'll get shut out. Make like a Mr. Meek, and you'll get cut out.
Make like hey, folks, welcome back. It's the Erickman Taxes Show. I'm talking to Jim Dennison. His book is How Does God See America? Jim, welcome back.
So glad to be with you today, Eric. So grateful for what you're doing and the chance to do it with you.
Well, let me ask you, thank you. I really, we were talking a moment ago about this idea that Lewis talks about, mere Christianity, and you said you think he got it from the Puritan Richard Baxter. But I do think it's an issue that there are people who, they don't get the basics. I know there are a lot of people who go to church many Sundays in a year, and they don't understand the basics. And that's kind of the issue for me. In other words, just what you said about Lewis, that you want to get people in the main room. And then from there, if they say, well, I think I'm interested in something, you know, incarnational, I'm interested in the Catholic or the Orthodox traditions, or other people are more low church, they're interested in something else. Those are choices that I would say, being, you know, pretty broadly ecumenical, that people can make. But the main thing is to understand the basics. And that's obviously what Lewis does in his book.
It is. And I completely agree with you, just as was the case in Lewis's day and is the case in our day. So many people are distracted by the non-essentials that they're missing the essentials. And then I remember this when I grew up not going to church at all. Why would I want to be a part of the fight that I saw churches having? Why would I want to be engaged in all of the controversies and all of the divisions that you see out there about these various rooms off of the main room, when really it's the main room that matters most? That was a real deterrent to me. It was a real turnoff when I heard about churches arguing with churches or Catholics and Protestants angry at each other, that sort of thing. So I think, first of all, it can be a distraction. And second, it can even be a disruption for people that really need to get into the house. If we can get them to the house, then we can trust the Holy Spirit to work in their lives to get them to whatever room might be his providential.
Well, we've all seen this, at least I've seen it many times. There are people that are more excited about their denomination than they are about Jesus, or they're more excited about their denomination than they are about the Bible. And you realize that they're really missing it. It's kind of like a tribal identity versus an identity with Jesus and understanding the basics. And that's usually how I guess when I encounter somebody like that, I know that they're kind of not getting the basics that we're talking about, because they're so obsessed with some of these details and they're missing the big picture.
That was true in my life. I happened to become a Christian through a Baptist church in Houston, Texas. This was back in the 1970s. And back in that day, there was a great deal of issue about the charismatic thing that was going on, the charismatic renewal. Catholics and Protestants were certainly at odds with each other. Vatican II hadn't really come to full expression yet. And there was a lot of sense that if you were a Catholic, you couldn't even be a Christian, and vice versa. There was some of that. And there's a lot of tribalism that I had to realize was inside me. Everybody wants to be right. Everybody wants, especially, to be the only person who's right, you know? And if you get the sense that my church is the only right church, or at least the most right church, then that carries with it a sense of superiority, a sense of affirmation that really draws me away from Jesus. So I'm not focused on Jesus so much as I am on what I'm doing for Jesus. And it gets to be a transactional religion instead of a transformational relationship. And I think we see that in the New Testament, don't we, with these Pharisees and Sadducees and some of the same issues then, that we want to be known for who we are and for where we are rather than for whose we are.
It's interesting, because I think the reason I was able to avoid this, largely speaking, is because I came out of a secular world. I came out of a world that was really hostile to Christianity. So when I became a Christian, I was just all in for that. And I was excited about the basics. But, you know, my experience is not typical. There are a lot of people who seem to think that the war is with people on the other side of this religious issue versus, you know, being at war with the devil, being at war with unbelief or whatever it is. And so it's a very different perspective. Now, I want to make sure I get this. What was your story, Jim? You said you came to faith in the 70s or whatever, but growing up, tell us a little bit more about that, how you did come to faith.
Well, actually, this book, Mere Christianity, that we've been talking about had a great deal to do with it. The one I have in my hand cost $1.95. So it probably isn't the most recent edition of this, you might say. I have a rubber band that I keep around it because it falls apart so much. So my father grew up in Kansas. He was a Sunday school teacher. He was so active in his church that in a small town in Kansas that a lot of his friends, we found out years later, thought he might actually go into vocational ministry. World War II began. Dad enlisted in the Army. He could type, so he was made a radio operator. He and 300 men were stationed on an island in the South Pacific. The Japanese knocked out the radio, killed a lot of the men. The Allies assumed they were all dead, and they left them on the island. 2.5 years later, they found my father and 16 other survivors.
Wait.
Living off that land.
Whoa.
And my father came back from that experience and never went to church again. So I grew up in a wonderful home, a loving home, but no spiritual life and all my dad's questions. You know,
I just want to ask you more about that, Jim, because that is a stunning story. So your father was left alone to survive on a remote Pacific island for 2.5 years.
He and a group of other men. There were 300 men there. They were stationed as a radio relay station in order to operate the radio relay. There were Japanese on the island, but the island was bisected by a mountain range. And so the Japanese on the other side couldn't physically attack, but they could lob shells over the mountains. And as I understand it, one day one of the shells knocked out the radio and killed a lot of the men. And when that happened, the Allies had no way to reach them, no way to contact them. It was a remote island. And they just, as I understand it, assumed that they were all dead. So they're doing the march to Japan, going island to island. And two and a half years later, they came to my father's island, and that's where they found Dad and 16 other survivors.
And your
another
father,
part of the story. I'm sorry.
When you say 16 other survivors, does your father tell the story? This sounds like a horrible story, whatever it is.
He told the story one time. That's how we know what I just said. He told it one time.
But did he tell what happened in those 2 years? I mean, when you talk about 16 survivors, so we're talking about some pain here. I can't even imagine.
Yeah, I can't either. And Dad wouldn't go there. He told that much one time, and that was all. That's so many of those war veterans did. That was all he would do. That was all he would say.
And he lost his faith, or did he just choose not to go to church?
We weren't sure. We really weren't clear. We went many years not knowing that. I didn't know that my dad was so active in church until years after he died. Dad had his first heart attack when I was 2 and died when I was a senior in college at the age of 55, having never been to church, having never had any kind of an active Christian faith at all. And so my brother and I honestly did not know where he was. He never did anything that caused us to know he wasn't a Christian, didn't do anything to defame the Lord, didn't do anything that would cause us to really think he really couldn't be a Christian, but had no active spiritual life that we knew. And then some years ago, my brother went back to my dad's hometown in Kansas, actually found some people that remembered my father. And that's how we heard the story of how active Dad had been in the church and used to teach Sunday school and thought he might actually go into ministry. And so we never got that story until some years later.
So he obviously saw evil and horrors and suffering, and he bottled all that up, and he came back, and like that generation, as you said, just chose not to talk about it, not to process it, not to deal with it, which... I mean, I can't even imagine, but I'm glad I asked you about that, because that's so few times do we, you know, remember what people suffered in the war, in particular,
right.
What they
that's
went
right.
through. My goodness. Anyway, so yeah. I didn't mean to.
No, thank you. That he had it. The rest of us, they had a skin disease that he contracted on that island that he suffered with the rest of his life. It was in so many ways, the event that really, as it did with so many men, really transformed his life. Some years ago, my mother passed away, 11 years ago now, but, she lived with us for a period of time, or lived in the same city as we did for several years, had a lot of her stuff up in the attic. So at one point I was moving one of her boxes and it fell apart. I was repacking it and I found a painting about, I would say maybe a foot and a half by 2 feet in size, of an island scene with the artists, W.F. Hall, and the number 48, 1948. I asked Mom what it was. Turned out one of the 17 survivors was a painter. He painted 17 copies of that island and gave one to each of the survivors. And I had found my father's painting.
Oh.
So it hangs above my computer at home in my study where I see it every day. But the C.S. Lewis part of that is I came to faith in Christ. I was invited to ride a bus to church at the age of 15, which is how I actually heard the gospel and eventually came to Christ, but had all my father's questions, all my father's issues, war, science and faith, evil and suffering, all that. And someone gave me Mere Christianity. It's the first time I'd ever seen anyone deal with the faith intellectually. And that's what made this so foundational for me.
How old were you?
I was a senior in high school at that point.
Well, I knew you were a smart guy, but I have to say, Mere Christianity, it's not such an easy book. So it's impressive not just that you read it, but that you let it speak to you in the way that it did, because it really is, it's the writing of a little bit different generation.
It is.
Because it's kind of funny, the guy who was sharing Jesus with me when I was 24 gave me a copy of Mere Christianity, and it was just like throwing BBs at a brick wall, just no effect. I read it. I was like, yep. But it just did not speak to me. I needed a miracle. I got a miracle, but it's just so interesting to me how everybody's different and how many people I've talked to where Mere Christianity, where this book by C.S. Lewis changed their whole life. Chuck Colson's one of them. We're going to be right back, folks. I'm talking to Jim Dennison. His book is How Does God See America? We'll be right back. When you're gone, go outside, how can I? Christian bestselling author and speaker Richard E. Simmons does not shy away from the big questions of life. His latest book is called Reflections on the Existence of God, and it tackles the biggest question of all: does God exist? I've read this book, and I got to tell you, I'm a little biased, but you can imagine that I like it a lot, because Simmons offers insights for those grappling with life's biggest questions. Where do we find meaning in life? Who determines what is evil? Can we be moral without God? Does God even exist? Former White House aide Wallace Henley says, I've taught apologetics for many years and I've read every scholar mentioned in this book. Of all the books on apologetics, Simmons is the best I have ever read. This book is easy to read because it's divided into a series of brief essays, perfect for a devotional or discussion with a friend. I highly recommend that you add a copy of Reflections on the Existence of God to your pandemic reading list. Simmons asks questions that speak directly to one of the most important things you possess, your worldview. Folks, you know how important this is to me. Your worldview is going to impact the way you live your life, for better or for worse. If you want to challenge yourself to spiritual and intellectual growth, and I hope you do, then be willing to ask yourself life's toughest questions. Dive in today by picking up a copy of Reflections on the Existence of God right now. Go to existenceofgodbook.com. That's existenceofgodbook.com. Hey there, folks. Welcome back. It's the Eric Metaxas Show. And guess what? I'm talking to Jim Dennison of the Dennison Forum. Jim, your book is How Does God See America? And, you know, you said that you just came out with a book about the COVID kind of situation that we find ourselves in right now. Now, if people want to get any of your books, are these all on Amazon? Do they just look up Dennison, or do they go to the Dennison Forum?
Could do either one. Yeah, they could look it up by my name on Amazon, but DennisonForum.org is really the way to get to all the content. They can get to the free daily article we do. I write a couple pieces a day for Facebook. We put on our website. They can find that. I send several tweets a day that they could find through that portal as well. And then we have other content providers. We have other brands as well. The First 15 is our devotional brand. We have a Christian parenting brand, my wife's Bible study content, and then we have a pastor brand as well.
You're doing a lot. I knew you were, but to hear you enumerated, it's kind of amazing. Well, let's talk for a minute just about where we are as a nation. Do you feel, it's hard not to wonder if this pandemic is some kind of judgment or some kind of, let's put it this way. For me, as a Christian, it's hard to believe that God is not involved in history. He's always involved in history. He always knows what's happening. And it does seem like this is so dramatic. Nothing in our lifetimes can compare to this, except perhaps, well, no, I was going to say 9/11 can't compare to this. This to me is like World War II. That's before our time. So, do you have a sense of where we are? Is this, you know, is this something that we should look at through prophetic eyes to say, what is God saying? Or how do you process it as a thinking Christian?
Well, thank you. Yeah, that's a terrific question. It's one of the first things I had to ask myself. Do I believe this to be a judgment from God in some specific way? Do I see this in some kind of prophetic sense? I came to decide no for myself in that context. When I see God using disease for specific supernatural judgment in the Bible, it's usually, it's always a supernatural thing. Plagues in Egypt, the affliction with Herod in Acts chapter 12. And there also seems to be a very specific prophetic warning about particular sin that has led to that judgment. I'm not aware of the specific sin that led to COVID particularly or in Wuhan or something specific to that. You could say it's God's judgment on communism or communistic government, but of course it's in America as well. You could say it's God's judgment on the Muslim world because of Iran, but again, it's in America. So I could decide not to see it primarily through that lens as a specific judgment of God. Certainly it's within his sovereignty. Certainly it's within his permissive will. And so second, there's kind of this prophetic question as well. Most of the people that see America through a prophetic lens, an end times lens, have decided that they don't see this fits into that scenario. And that's not really the way I particularly look at the book of Revelation myself. I'm looking at it myself in the context of the redemption motif. I believe that God redeems all that he allows. Because he's sovereign, he must allow all that happens. Because he's all love, he wants our best, clearly. And so I believe God is in the business right now of redeeming for greater good everything he allows or causes. I'm not saying I understand that redemption. I don't understand the technology by which we're having this conversation right now. But I believe we should be looking right now along this line. What can I do right now to serve Jesus I couldn't do before? What is God doing right now as a result of this that wasn't happening before? Familiar with the church in California that had 8,000 people in their online worship service that had 1.3 million people for their Easter service, for instance. We're hearing of ministries that are seeing enormous response to the gospel. I'm sorry?
What church was that?
Let's see.
It's not Greg Laurie's church.
It is Greg Laurie's church.
Greg Laurie, is Greg of course, is a friend. Mm-hmm. He's a friend of mine. He's been on this program many times, and but I wasn't aware that they had that many people watching. There's something going on. It's going to take us some time to process because it's happening right now, and we can't get perspective on it. But the idea that no one's going to church, but that tons of people are watching church services and sermons online. I think, you know, that's going to change us forever. There's just something about this, the accessibility of sermons that suddenly people maybe who wouldn't get in a car and drive to church, but they will turn on their computer and listen to a sermon. It's going to change us. I hope people are coming to faith. I hope that there are people that have been forced to deal with the big questions during this weird, difficult time and have come to find the God of the Bible who loves them. I hope, but I just don't know. And I don't know if you have any views on what is happening right now.
That's the other side of it. Number one, the accessibility is on an unprecedented level, as you say. I remember growing up, as I said, not going to church at all. And part of the turnoff for me was having to find a church to go to, trying to figure out how to get in, how not to embarrass yourself. What do you wear? Where do you sit? When do you stand? None of that's a barrier now because anybody has the gospel accessible to them online, as you're saying. And we're seeing an enormous response, statistical response. Our own website traffic more than doubled. We're seeing our podcast stuff has more than doubled as people are really looking for biblical truth. But the other side of it, the negative side, is we're more accepting or at least more admitting of mortality than ever before.
Right.
Well, I could have COVID right now and not know it. The next person I meet could infect me and not know it. There are all sorts of ways in which this could impact us and really demonstrates the reality of our mortality on a level that the Holy Spirit can redeem and use to draw people to Christ, I pray.
I think we have to go to a break here. Am I right, guys? We're going to break? Okay, we're going to be right back. Folks, I'm talking to Jim Dennison. It's the Eric Metaxas Show. Hey, folks, welcome back to the Eric Metaxas Show. I'm talking to Jim Dennison with the Dennison Forum, dennisonforum.org. There's all kinds of stuff at the dennisonforum.org if you're interested. And if you're not interested, there's still plenty of stuff there. So, Jim, we've just got this final segment left. You were in the middle of some thoughts before we went to the break.
The thing that really, at the end of the day, Eric, I really want us to think about as we're trying to redeem this time, as we're looking for ways to express the gospel, or ways to make a difference that we couldn't have had otherwise, the thing I'd really want us to do is to focus on our own influence. Where is it that God's given you resource? Where is it that God's given you experience or education or background where you can really be using that influence in a way that will make the greatest impact for the gospel? All through Scripture, you see people focusing in what they do best. It's that business model of good to great and focusing on what you do best and finding whether it's your gifts, your passion, your influence, and then using that as effectively as possible. Well, this is going to sound a little patronizing, I'm afraid, but I've said this about you over the years, may as well say it to you. I see you as a great example of that, as somebody who's really a cultural missionary. You could live anywhere. You could do anything. You're living in New York City, and you're doing this. And you're doing this to use your gifts and your abilities, your influence, your communicational gifts, in order to be able to put a terrific reasoned face on the gospel for the sake of people who might see the Christian movement in perhaps a different way than that. And that's an example of what I would really ask people to pray about. Lord, how can I do this? How can I do in my context what Eric does in his context? How could you use me most effectively where you've put me in my kingdom assignment? If we'll think in those terms, I promise you the Lord will answer that prayer.
That's, well, thanks for saying that. And I do have to say that, you know, when I came to faith, I mean, I referred to it earlier, I had come out of, you know, going to a place like Yale University, being in and around, you know, the cultural elites of New York City, very, very secular, and not just secular, but hostile to serious Christian faith, certainly hostile to conservative political ideas. And when I really understood what I believed, I thought, I'm behind enemy lines. I'm among people who don't. And, you know, I don't mean real enemies, but I'm saying people who are different from me ideologically. But I feel like God gave me the ability to speak their language. You know, missionaries, you want to be able to communicate with the people and not have cultural differences that get in the way of the message, you know. And I thought, well, I am one of these people. And so I need to kind of in a sense, translate the gospel into the language of that people group. And of course that involves humor or sarcasm or whatever it is. It's not like it was really conscious on my part, but I just realized that's kind of what God, you know, chose for me to do. But it means a lot to me when folks like you kind of see that, because of course it's important to me. The most important thing in the world is for us to communicate this beautiful thing that we have no right to know. You know, I was praying with my wife this morning, like, why do we have this privilege, this honor of knowing God personally? And I think that it's one of the reasons we want to share it with everyone we know, because we realize, I don't deserve this. I didn't do anything to earn this. This is this gift, and I want to give it away to as many people as conceivably possible. And, you know, obviously writing books and having a radio program can help a little bit. But I just think that most people have places in their lives, you just said it, where God has put them. And so whoever's listening, where God has put you and wants you to influence those around you. And it really is, you're right, Jim. When you pray that prayer, God, use me, he wants to use you. So if you pray that prayer, he will answer that
absolutely
prayer.
And he's been building in your life to this very point. I lead study tours to Israel a lot. I've done that more than 30 times. I've been to Greece and Turkey more than 10 times. And we always go up to the Mars Hill, you know, there at Athens. And I cite Paul's statement there in Acts 17, his sermon there in Acts 17. So here he is quoting Epimenides and Arades, these Greek philosophers, which he grew up in Tarsus, somehow knowing. I'm quite certain that when Saul the Pharisee was learning about Greek philosophy or growing up around that, he didn't know that one day he'd be quoting that stuff in the context of a Christian apologetic presentation right at the Areopagus itself. So anything God's calling you to do now, he's already prepared you to do. He's already built that into your life. He didn't set you up to fail. He didn't call you into this without preparing you to do it. So know what your kingdom assignment is. Know what your gifts, your passion, your heart are. Know where God can lead you most effectively to make that connection. And then know that he plans to use you for his glory if you're just willing to be used.
It's beautifully put. I always say that, quoting Viktor Frankl or whomever, what we need in life, what everybody's looking for, is meaning. We want to know, what's the meaning of my life? What's the meaning of life? Why am I here? We crave it. God created us to crave meaning. And when we know him, we find our meaning. And our meaning, of course, is at least in part to communicate him and his love and his person. And it makes waking up in the morning an exciting venture, because we are on a mission. We're on a mission from God, to quote the Blues Brothers, right? And what could be more wonderful than to live your life knowing that whatever I'm doing, working my job, raising my kids, whatever, all that I'm doing is part of a mission from God for his purposes, that he's with me, he's prepared me. It really is. It's just a beautiful thing, and it's a privilege. And I know it's a big part of your life, is communicating those ideas to people.
And as you say, it's such a privilege to get to do this. I'm not going to have anything to do with the person or with creating a vaccine for COVID. I'm not a medical researcher. I'm not in the labs. If they're depending on me, they're in trouble, right? But I'm going to be so grateful for the people that do that. Just like I'm grateful I never got polio because of Jonah Salk. So if I have this vaccine that's been given to me that I can give to other people, how can I not do that out of gratitude for the grace that I've received? And then that makes evangelism and ministry really just an overflow of your heart, of your love relationship with Jesus. As you were saying before, it's not about church and denomination. It's really about Jesus and being so grateful for him and serving, not so he'll love me, but because he loves me. Sharing this with other people, not so God will bless me, but because God has blessed me. That's what makes Christianity so unique, is this transformational relationship that we get to have with the Son of God himself.
It's almost, it's almost unbelievable. That's why it's just so exciting and so crazy, and so beautiful. And and one of the things I get to do on this program that gives me joy and meaning and purpose is introducing people to others that I have discovered and become fond of, like you. So Jim Dennison, we're out of time, but I just want to say so grateful for you and what you do. So grateful for your willingness to come on this program. I want to remind people, go to DennisonForum.org. Jim, thank you so much.
So glad to be with you today, Eric. God bless.
Don't you cry no more.
Hey there, folks. What a day. What a day. What a day. Oh, my goodness. We got to talk to Jim Dennison. We got to talk to who did we talk to about No Safe Spaces? Was that Prager?
That was Dennis Prager. Yeah.
I always get Dennis Prager confused with a lot of people. You know, when I had Dennis Prager on, we did a live Facebook live thing. And I'm so close to him and I love him so much that I'll say anything to him. So I was joking around with him about his weight. I said, Dennis, have you put on weight? And I realized, like, he's not heavy. He's just like a big guy, right? But then I thought, uh-oh, I've crossed the line. I've crossed the line with Dennis because he's such a nice guy. He would never hit back. You know what I'm saying? So I don't know what I'm going to do about that. I just love him. You know, some people, you just love him so much, you go crazy. I love that guy so much. I can't even take it. Anyway, I'm glad we had him on the program today. No Safe Spaces. I mean, there's certain people that are getting attacked for doing God's work. Dennis is at the top of the list. He has been so attacked, but he takes it with this kind of just wonderful equanimity. He doesn't get angry. He's a darling. I love him. If he hadn't been married for the third time, I'd be Mrs. Prager number four. I promise you. If things are on the rocks between him and his current wife, I'm in line.
High praise indeed.
We've got to say this. I want to play the Facebook Live that I did with him. We need to get that and to play it on this program because it was fun. It was with Adam Carolla. Carolla, man, he's awesome. So we need to get that. But let me just say, just before we go, we're still trying to raise as much money as possible for Angel Tree and Prison Camp. If you care about genuinely underprivileged young people in America, this is exactly the right thing to do. This is not some government program that's going to be wasted on some political correct nonsense. This is to help young people whose moms and dads are in prison right now. So you go to MetaxasTalk.com or you can click on the banner. But I want to ask you maybe to call 888-206-2793. 888-206-2793. We had a $10,000 gift. I know there are people out there, you're hiding money. You need to stop hiding it. You need to bring it out and give it to Angel Tree. It is one of those things that you just can't go wrong. They're the best of the best, and they're helping people that really need help. The government is not helping these young kids or these families. It's in many cases doing harm to them. So just go to our website, MetaxasTalk.com, or click on 888-206-2793, 888-206-2793. Chris Himes, I just got to tell you, our subscriptions have gone way up on YouTube.
On YouTube, yeah, yeah. We got a lot of great stuff on there. Albin's been booking some amazing guests, so people want to see the clips.
It's unbelievable, and we even have some black people on there, which is ironic since everybody was calling me a racist. It doesn't have the narrative. I get very confused. Let me just say that, you know, somebody said something about my tweet, now deleted, that it was like Twitter blackface or something like that. And I thought that's like saying that's architectural rock and roll. Like, I don't know what that means. But when you think about the fact that we have a governor of Virginia who literally wore blackface and posted it in his yearbook, and then you have Justin Trudeau, the head of a country in North America, who many times wore blackface, like they're still in power. So like the woke mobs, they seem to be kind of selective. Is that just me? I think, first of all, we need grace, number one. But secondly, we need to inform ourselves before we call people racist. We are all screwed up. I know I'm screwed up. But
I know you're screwed up too.
On a theologically positive note. So, all right, folks. Tomorrow, we're going to have on John Zmirak. Holy cow. Till then.